prefer as far as air in and air out. But I'm loving it. I absolutely love it because it's that basis of a lot of the treatments that we can provide to people. We begin there. It's the BLS interventions that really provide the security blanket that we fall back to. Now, Troy, how much experience do you have in EMS as far as airway interventions? I start rambling about stuff like this. How much experience do you have in EMS? Let's start off there.
Okay. I have, like, no experience with EMS. Like, the most experience that I have is, like, in WWE when I see the guys get thrown into a stretcher or carried out of an arena.
Right.
And then they start beating the hell out of a guy in the ambulance.
Yep. That's where, A, all of our psych patients, that's a true story that does happen. And, B, you know, we were talking
You're
about
kidding. They literally get up and start fighting?
One of my favorite stories, like, absolutely, yeah. In Milwaukee, I've heard of a couple people, like, you're calling an ambulance, right? And you call an ambulance, you never let yourself between you and the patient in the door, right? So you always have a route of egress. And they would, like, call an ambulance in a psych patient would lock the door and say, you know, like, I'm here to eat your face now. And yeah, I have stories of, you know, a couple of EMTs, whoa, ping, to the head with an oxygen bottle, you know, but it's that world that we live in, right? It's, you know, it's what gives us that that gumption or that, you know, bravado that we have of pre-hospital. It's an uncontrolled environment. So yeah, absolutely. I've been in the back doing, you know, the old Rochambeau and Rotangle up with your patient while they're swinging and trying to bite at you, you know, like,
oh my
you look
God.
Like Beavis and Butthead sometimes. If they're starting to spit at you, you pull the head up and, you know, shirt up and over. So you're saying you've never called an ambulance before?
Never. Yeah, I've never called an ambulance before.
And you know what? That's not actually that odd, which, you know, we're really? All knocking on wood. You hear a couple pounds out there. But it's actually not that of an oddity to have someone who's never called or contacted EMS. That's a good thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, you think about how many emergencies people encounter in their life. Like me, I ride on an ambulance all the time. I think I've called 911 once in my entire life, which is weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm surrounded with it, and I've only had to rely on those resources
now,
once.
I have a question for you, Austin. Like, do you hesitate to – I mean, have there been more than one situation? Has there been?
That's a really good question.
Because do you hesitate because you know what people go through to have to reach out to you or get to you?
You know, like, this is a very – this question I have to answer both dualities of this side, right? Like, my side – listen here. I better be. If I'm going to call an ambulance, I'm going to be on my deathbed, two broken stumps, and I'm probably still going to be crawling to the hospital, right? Like,
oh,
I'm not going to call that ambulance over my dead body. Do I want? And I'm kidding a little bit, but, you know, obviously, healthcare providers are the worst patients out there. But on the other side, you know, I think it is a huge advantage for me to have all this training and expertise, because then I can see, oh my goodness, that's not just sick, you need an ambulance. That, you know, that person fell off me and my family were up at Devil's Lake, and we were driving away from the beach there, and I look up and a four-wheeler flips, or a three-wheeler, excuse me, right in front of us, flips, and it ejects the patient off, and the wife is off to the other hand side, so we have two people ejected, and no one thought it was necessary. Let's just roll the three-wheeler back on its wheels and drive away. No one thought it was necessary to call the ambulance, right? And to me, in those moments, you know, like, if you had me try to reset a MacBook, right, I am lost. I am up that creek without a paddle, swimming with my little hands, you know, like, help me now.
Right.
But it's that stress magnified, but we can control it, right? Emergency, someone calls 911, it's the worst day of their life, presumptuously, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then anybody, this kind of ties into the last question you asked, anybody who calls 911 is not of right mind and should be treated that way. Now, I'm not saying, like, we, you know, immediately think and stereotype and look at you and treat you differently. No. We're giving you a wide berth, right? Because understandably so, this is the worst day of your life. Whether it's a toe pain or you cut your arm off, you're having an emergency, right? But, you know, these
Please don't tell me you saw someone with an arm cut off, like self literally sawing off their arm.
Oh, yeah.
You've
yeah.
seen that.
Yeah.
You're kidding.
No. I have a good friend. He actually lost his arm. My girlfriend's a really good friend. He lost his arm in a farming accident. Yeah, so, I mean, it happens. And what's weird is I saw him come into the hospital while I was working in the emergency room.
Oh, wow.
I mean, so that happens all the time, honestly. It you know, like, amputations, especially in the Wisconsin area, you know, with lots of farming commitments, equipment and stuff like that. So traumatic amputations is, you know, quite real.
Wow.
Secret time? Yeah, we'll throw this out there. It's always a giggle for me, and this will get a laugh on your face, Troy. I swear to you, this is not a made-up story. One day, an individual came into the emergency room. This is not a lie. He was working on his jet ski and had an amputation of a certain appendage. Yeah, you just go ahead and think about that. And it wasn't his arms or legs. Hey there. Yeah, it was not. So for, and I honestly, I'm not lying to you, I had to carry that appendage up to the OR for him. So for one day, I was a professional handler. That's right. Yeah. You know, and obviously we carry that and manage those appropriately because, you know.
Can you sew that back on?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Wow. And they did. They did indeed. But, you know, again, there's aspects of this job you will never see coming at you, right?
Yeah, literally.
Isn't that the truth? Hi. But, you
wow.
know,
how do you even get that I'm sorry. Okay,
yeah,
I'll let it
again,
go.
You know, nothing will surprise you in the pre-hospital setting. It's uncontrolled, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we kind of got on this rambunct here, and I ramble, you know that. But in the back of the ambulance, that is our office, you know, and we start thinking about airway interventions. You try to control that office as much as you can. That's our safe spot, right? So, you know, you never called an ambulance, right? But if an ambulance did show up for that crazy day that you're having, the place that we can control is the back there. So you see a lot of the times, you know, some people might show up. If I do show up and I think the situation's escalated, crazy, uncontrolled, maybe it's an officer-involved shooting, loved ones are on location, maybe it is a traumatic amputation, and mm-hmm. this one over here can't, you know, doesn't want to look at the amputated arm.
Right.
I'm going to take you. I'm going to put you in my office, right? Mm-hmm. We can control that. We can control what happens in the back of the ambulance. Mm-hmm. And then if you take that same ideology and put it into your patient assessment. Mm-hmm. So you may think and kind of assume, I guess, of we're just savants, right? We walk around, we just smell when you're sick. Oh, look, you're having asthma. Or,
right.
You know, oh, look, like that's, you know, amputated arm, that's pretty obvious, you know.
Right.
But
see, you know what? That's what I would think,
right?
Right? In that case, that you guys are just magical wizards that can go in and just poof, you know,
right.
And at least take care of patients
sure.
on the way to the hospital.
Absolutely.
For the next step to continue.
Well, the man behind the mirror, right? You know,
right.
peering behind, seeing Oz here. You know, what it actually is our patient assessment. And we have this grid we're taught at a very entrance level. You know, your first responder, even your first aid, right? You know, do you have your CPR card by chance?
No, I really
no, CPR.
That.
Come on down, right? but your CPR, right? As soon as you get your first aid CPR instruction, you know, you walk up to a patient and you're like, sir, ma'am, are you all right? And that's me pounding on the table here. And mm-hmm. you're shake, right? Because if you think about it, me cromping on your chest, you know, separating your sternum and breaking a couple ribs because you're having a nap, it's a bad day. Bad day.
Mm-hmm.
That right there, you're already assessing the patient responsiveness. How they respond based on that assessment is now dictating how you treat that patient. Oh, they didn't respond. I'm going to look, listen, and feel. Do I see a chest rise? Do I palpate a pulse? And that's usually the scariest thing that could happen to pre-hospitally, right? Your patient dies. But, man, it's one of the easiest things to manage.
Hmm.
And then we think now in the back of the ambulance, and I'm tying in airway here, we use our patient assessment, and we have these set standards, right? So we have our scene size up. Stuff as we're rolling up to the scene, is it safe? What sort of equipment do I need to have on me? Is it Ebola? I better, you know, like hazmat suit up and not eat some vomit, right? Keep
right.
the poo-poo to you. But, you know, do I need additional resources? C-spine, these things we're all asking, those are kind of standard. But then we mm-hmm. get into our primary assessment. Primary, are mm-hmm. you dying? Yes or no? Let's find that stuff. Fix it. And honestly, like, yeah, if we're doing it right, if you have a lot of experience and good training and good quality content review, you can do this like I'm having a conversation with you, right?
Mm-hmm.
I won't walk in and go, Troy, how you doing today? What? Okay, so I have a 27-year-old male looking me at the face, awake, alert, oriented, right? You'd start thinking like I'm a robot if I started saying that to you.
Right.
But we're doing it inside of our
internally.
Head. These are the things that we're checking off. And honestly, ABCs, that's the first thing we're caring about. Our airway, our breathing, work of breathing, whether it's shallow, inadequate, are you short of breath? We can start giving some O's. Remember, if you're an SOB, you give O2 to me, throwing some oxygen on there. But then you have your C circulation. What's really cool is you got to think about globally. If you can break it down to a bite-sized piece, that's how we do EMS. Honestly, mm-hmm. it's that simple. If you don't have an airway, nothing else really matters, right?
Right.
You're going to be dying really quickly.
So what are ways that you can manage that? I mean, obviously, there's the oxygen mask.
Great, yeah.
I mean,
that's a really, you know what? That's a really good question. So it's that I like to think of it as a pyramid, right? You see Grey's Anatomy, you think of what? Everybody who is short of breath, they get what? They get that tube thrown into the throat, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they never miss, and they're savants. Now, if you watch a lot of, you know, online documentation or even those shows, you'll see a Yankow or suction tip in someone's mouth, you know, pretending to be an ET tube. But, you know, like us, that's the very tippy top. That's an advanced airway. I have to look through your throat, visualize your vocal cords, and place a tube into the trachea, an endotracheal tube. At the bottom, the basis, you're short of breath. Absolutely. I'm sure you've seen some football players, you know, hustling down the field too much, head over to the sideline and sucking on some O's, right? They put that oxygen mask. That's a non-rebreather mask. Right. You're not rebreathing air. So you have a reservoir down here that's giving you extra oxygen that should be nice and filled. That might help. But, Troy, what happens if you're not breathing on your own now? We got to do that for you, right? And so that now we're escalating into just a little bit more advanced. If I can provide an artificial ventilation to you or mechanically ventilate you, moving air in and out of your lungs by squeezing on a bag, causing your chest to rise, and then I'm now providing you air into your lungs. Now, I'm not respirating you, but I'm ventilating you, giving you air. Now, here's some problems, though. If you're Wisconsin skinny like me, I got a little fat neck and I'm a little short, right?
If you're fat, then I'm like the 500-pound guy who's like in his
home.
We're
all Wisconsin skinny, right? Yeah. 10 to 50 to 500, right? We all got a little bit. You know, like I got this cheese curd stew underneath my chin here that I'm hanging on to. And if you think about it, right, that becomes a problem managing. You know, we don't have a good ability to reposition your airway, open it, right? Because if you think it's really hard to breathe, tuck your chin down to your chin, or chin down to your chin, good Lord. If you tuck your chin down to your chest and then try to take a big, deep breath, you know, it's almost impossible, right? Your airway, that highway, is now crumped off. Well, here's some super easy interventions and assessments you can do on effectiveness of ventilation. You should be able to see it. Every time you breathe, your chest comes up. Every time you breathe out, chest comes down. That's a good, adequate chest rise. How do I know you're getting adequate ventilations? Well, you're getting a good, adequate chest rise. All right. Okay. Well, what could affect our ability between our lungs and our mouth? The number one in an unresponsive patient, you guessed it, that big, fat, floppy tongue falls to the back of your oral pharynx, and then all of a sudden, snoring respirations incur. Now, what can we do to fix that? We have an oral pharyngeal airway, an oral airway. We can place that into your oral pharynx, depresses the back part of your tongue, and keeps that tongue out of the way, so now you have that highway that's nice and open.
Okay, well, see, the question is most people don't like that sensation.
You're correct.
Right, and so that's when you might see people swinging or doing some sort of, get the hell off
me. Thankfully, you messed up real bad if you're deciding to put that on a patient who's conscious, because one of the indications is an absence of a gag reflex, right? So if I put this in your mouth and you start gagging, right? Well, A, that's an assessment. Hey, at least you have an intact gag. And I'm going to go ahead and remove this, right?
Right.
Some people, you know, definitely might still be conscious but still need to be ventilated, right? Well, we could give a nasal pharyngeal airway, a trumpet that goes through your nose. We can put one in either one of your nares, and then we can provide ventilations, not through that per se because we'll still give you a mask, but these are your basic life-saving interventions that you learn at even in an EMT basic level. But honestly, Troy, if you're thinking about that, you know, surgical interventions, ooh, crike, maybe cutting a hole into your throat and putting a tube in there, man, that's a, you think about those 0.00001%, like crazy, crazy high.
And do you guys have the tools out in the field to do that?
Oh, yes. Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
wow.
And I mean, but again, you think about, and I was trying to tell my class today, one of two things, and I said three continuously because I'll still come up with the third one, but one of two things really kind of happened if you're criking somebody. One, all the EMS gods decided it's your day, right? All the things are against you, whether it be all of your airways failed, your patient's so sick, this is just that one crazy EMS journal case that, unfortunately, you have been blessed with. Or two, you messed up really, really bad, right? Like you messed up your RSI, you messed up rapid sequence intubation, you messed up your endotracheal intubation, you messed up all the other basic life-saving interventions we're talking about now that led you to, this is the last thing I got. I got to slice a hole in my patient's neck and put a tube in there.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And see, that would be scary. Like,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I can't even think of something more scary than that. Because even in, let's say, a surgery, right, you have doctors who are trained and hopefully they've done more than one freaking surgery.
Yeah, you would hope so.
You would hope. So the fact that this might be in the worst case scenario in those few minutes to the hospital might be the only recourse.
That might be the best place to do it. Not the best place, but in the best situation, you're in the back of the ambulance.
Right.
In the worst situation, you're in a silo upside down full of cow poop. You know, you dropped your monitor. Your partner forgot the directions, doesn't know how to do a crike. You're 5 minutes late. Fire department's still on its way. They can't fly because med flight doesn't want to fly with the ceiling too low and you're 45 minutes away from the hospital.
Wow.
Are there
cases where you've been 45 minutes away from a hospital?
Oh, that's not that abnormal. My previous department that I worked at, you know, your average response to the hospital was about 45 minutes.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so now imagine you're having sickness, right? I have to manage you for that 45 minutes in, right?
And see, that to me, like, is very different than a city like Boston or Chicago, where sure. there is a hospital probably within 10, 15 minutes yep. if you're in the core.
Throw them outside the window and they'll hit the hospital.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. yeah. You know, but, like, there's benefits and downsides to both of those. I love that because it gives me the ability to think, provide. I get to be a paramedic, right? A gangster, paragod in that pre-hospital setting. You know, like, I get to use my skills, but that's what separates me as a paramedic from an EMT basic, my critical thinking ability. What's happening? Thinking 5, 10, 15 steps ahead if that doesn't work the way I want it to. Continually building this rapport with my patient. That's awesome to me. But then again, I also like the intercity. Inner city, I guess is the better word to say. Inner city, there's a lot more incidence of people, so you have a lot more sick people. So it tends to have a little or lower access to healthcare. Even if they are right there, you see a lot of people that just don't choose to go or even have the means to access healthcare. So you right. see a lot of sick people, and you can turn them out. You know, Kenosha's running a crazy amount of calls out of one of the ambulances in 24 hours. You know, not every ambulance around here does that. You know, some ambulances, they, you know, these firefighters, paramedics will give you the air quotes of like, we're working a 24-hour shift, and then the first thing you'll hear is like, you're up 24 hours? You know, Kendrick Lamar said, there's levels to this game, yeah. right? There is. And don't be fooled. There is, you know.
Right.
There's a couple savages out there, right? Yeah, your Kenoshas, your, you know, your bigger city individuals who are up for 24 hours, running calls nonstop. Yeah, it's crazy.
And see, that's interesting to me because I wouldn't think in Kenosha, I mean, and again, this could be very naive, but that there'd be enough incidents?
Oh, yeah.
In the city of Kenosha?
Yeah.
I mean, it's relatively a sleeper town. Maybe sure. I'm wrong.
Sure, sure.
But have you heard, I mean, obviously we don't want to violate HIPAA laws,
yeah, yeah.
but have you heard crazy stories from the city of Kenosha?
You know, the craziest part is like, you know, talk to anybody who's ever worked in an ER or talk to anybody who's worked in pre-hospital medicine in general, fire, EMS, both of those are medicine, you know, just the pre-hospital services in general, right? So your law enforcement, protective services in general. It happens everywhere. The crazies are all around you, you know, and the crazy stories, honestly, yeah, you have more calls occur. You have more possibility for that to happen. But, I mean, honestly, like, things in places they shouldn't be, things missing where they shouldn't, people running around displaying certain ways, you name it, it's happening. And the crazies, yeah, I mean, one good way to say this, and here, this should hopefully build a metaphor or a visual for you that would maybe be a little bit better articulated. I say to my students, you know, in the first, and we had this conversation once on the podcast, kind of, the first month of your EMS career, it doesn't matter where you are, Dane, USA, right? Super small town near, out of Dane, the county of Dane, or, you know, Milwaukee. I guarantee my students, you'll see one of two, if not two of two calls guaranteed. One, chest pain, welcome to Wisconsin, right? Wisconsin skinny. We have the old heart attack problems, right? Beer, cheese, and a little bit more cheese, please.
Right.
But you'll also see an overdose, and that's guaranteed. That's my personal guarantee. You will see that within your first month that you're working. And that alone should kind of, like, maybe make more sense to you of, like, wait a second. I thought, you know, your Milwaukee's, your bigger cities are having these problems. No. It's everywhere. And that really extends that problem. You know, you have outerlying agencies that don't have access to healthcare, meaning are readily available hospitals. You still have head-on car collisions that are very, very bad, right?
Mm.
But you can't just turn around and head into the hospital. You know, you got to manage this patient for 45. Uh-oh, we're getting close to that golden hour. There's a lot you have to consider. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
And see, that's – I want to touch on that, too, because I was talking to someone at Harvard, people who might watch WGCD or listen to
us. What's up, Harvard?
Knows that I go there. So I was talking to one of my professors, and I said that you said that you tell people, EMS students – that when they go out to expect an opioid
absolutely.
Or some sort of overdose, can you touch on that? Like,
yeah,
how
absolutely.
Prevalent is it really?
Ridiculous. Yeah, nothing you read in the headlines will do enough to punch you in the face.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's really scary and it's really sad because with an increased incidence in EMS, what is the path of least resistance? Complacency and burnout, right? Oh, we got this again. Another over. It was just here last week. And then I could tell you, like, hey, Troy, close your eyes and paint me a picture of someone who's overdosing on a narcotic or an opiate, right? previously, if we're all stereotypingly appropriately, right, that's kind of EMS based upon these previous experiences. A patient clenched their fist and stood in this way. I'm going to stereotype appropriately and get out of the way so I don't get punched in the face, right? Or, you know, we're kind of taking these pieces of data and statistics, symptoms, signs. So what would you think, right? I could tell you, you know, like, oh, you're responding to the back alley of X, Y, and Z bar with, you know, for a 42-year-old super skinny individual, right, dirty, unclean, and you're like, oh, you know, maybe possibly homeless, minimal access to health care, possible long history of mental health problems, and okay.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. Who I would
Bingo, got say. It. Yeah. Or your quintessential, you know, you look at your the movie, right, with a belt around the arm, you know, or the rubber gasket, right?
The
you know,
orange American tint gangster of style. The light.
Yeah. You know, like, yeah. Right? And that one fateful decision. But you know what's really crazy? And, you know, it just really hurts my heart because guilty as charged. I'll be the first one to admit. I will jump on this and completely admit, yeah, I was one of them. I was one of them that would show up, and I just cannot understand. I was literally just doing compressions on your chest. I've drilled you with an IO. I've brought you all the way to the hospital. I've finally resuscitated you halfway to the hospital. You're awake, alert, conscious, super combative. That's one thing most people don't know. If I reverse your opiate overdose, 99.9 repeating, I took away your high, I've blocked some of those receptors, now we've reversed it, I've given you naloxone or Narcan, you become punch me in the face combative. Now I was just trying to save your life, right?
Right.
Now how do I feel in that moment? I feel almost a little jaded, like taken, like, hey, I'm doing everything I can. Because remember, every patient I see, if I say it, I mean it, I'm doing the best I can. So that doesn't change. Either you're overdosing, if you're having a heart attack, and then I get you to the hospital, you rip out the IO, you leave the hospital AMA to head down to a certain part of the city to go and get more drugs. I feel like I'm making one step forward, six steps back, right? Mm-hmm. And that, and this might just be Austin's feeling. This just might be me, right?
I might
be crazy, right?
No, I don't think so. I think that there's many other people.
But you look. Yeah. You look at the headlines. What was the billion-dollar payout that Johnson & Johnson and all the other pharma companies just paid out?
Yeah.
Cities? There was documentation I showed my medic class during pharmacology. I made him watch a documentary, and during the documentary, the advertisement is, statistics have shown that these drugs are not addicting.
Right.
One in seven doctors, and it's like in, you know, the early 2000s, and we're just giving them away like pills and candy. You look at Florida, they have the, you know, their turnaround. Half the pharmacy is connected to a clinic where you can go and get a script filled right that day. But what's so nuts, here's some stats coming at your face. More people in this country abuse prescription opiates than abuse tobacco.
Wow.
Let that resonate for a second. You know anybody that smokes or chews? Of course you do, right?
Yeah.
That statistically, that means, just think about that. And what's really crazy is there's enough prescription opiates written right now, prescriptions, to have every single adult in this country to have their own.
Jeez.
That's nuts. The plethora of drugs that we have available out there, now that narrative is changing and it's affecting everyone. It's the police officer for your local community who got you know, caught breaking into the narc drop boxes because he's trying to steal narcotics and opiates from the narc drop boxes. And
that's
he's
happened?
A police officer. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And again, though, like, why? Run it back. Run the timeline back. 3 months ago, he was on the job, twist his back, hurt his back. Doc said, here, right? How does this narrative work? We just need to change the narrative. That's what it is, you know? You show up. Yeah, you're going to get me on a tangent here, but you know, you show up, right? You show up to my house, and I'm a 97-year-old grandma. You know, this is a line I use all the time. I'm a 97-year-old grandma. I have a laterally rotated hip. I've got this big throw rug in the middle of my living room that I tripped on. Troy, what would you do in the route to the hospital? Probably talk about, hey, here's a trip hazard, and you could prevent this, right?
Mm-hmm.
Cool. With that broken hip, why are we not having a conversation about opiates?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we not having a conversation of, like, listen, NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, things like ibuprofen, they do more for musculoskeletal pain, has been documented, than specifically narcotics.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, let's talk about like that healing thing. Have you ever gotten a prescription for any opiates or had anybody, you know, fill that for you, pain meds?
Well, see, and I was a little kid.
Sure.
So I had like a stiff neck. I mean, I slept on it wrong or something, and it was stiff. And they prescribed some form of opiate.
Sure.
And I was a kid at this point. Yeah. I was a minor.
Right.
And I said, you know what, Mom? I'm not going to take this.
Oh, that's really impressive. It is.
And so I just did a hot compress mm-hmm. on it, and it took a lot longer. It took about 2 to 3 weeks
sure.
to get it back to normal.
Sure.
But I said, I'm not going to take this because, and honestly, I don't want to go too much deeper, but I mean, just because for time's sake, but my father was a drug addict.
Okay.
And so I was always nervous to end up like
Absolutely.
Him.
Yeah.
And so anytime I got pills or what have you, I was sure. like, I don't know.
Yeah.
So I would only do, like you said, ibuprofen yeah. or whatever, and then allergy medicine because I had bad spring allergies. But even then, I would take some for a week and then not take it for 3 days just sure. to prove to myself sure. that yeah. I'm not addicted
yeah.
to the
absolutely.
Ibuprofen.
Absolutely. You know, right. Troy, that's really crazy because you think about where I was going to go with this is, you know, like what instruction does that doctor give you? And I'm not saying every – I promise I'm not trying to label, you know, generalize every single doctor and every single police officer who's, you know, broken into narc boxes. I'm not generalizing by any means. But, you know, like this is the narrative of America. And the narrative is like you go in, you break your wrist. You'll get a pain med in the hospital most likely, right? They'll mm-hmm. fix it, do whatever they need to do, set it, reset, schedule surgery, cool. Now you go home in a cast. And you go home with a prescription, don't you? Yeah, you do, for, let's just say, 30 Percocet. Okay. Mm. What's the instruction that you get from that doctor? And what's the narrative behind that? Your parents, everybody else, they go, man, you should probably take one of these pills before you go home, you know, because you want to get ahead of the pain. You don't want that pain.
They say that?
Oh, yeah, get ahead of the pain. Yeah, take one now so you get ahead of the pain. Okay, think about the narrative then. The narrative is acute injury, opiate numb. Better. Where was the healing? Mm. Where in there did I get better? You know, mm-hmm. you felt development in your neck, right? You felt that this is taking a while, but the things I am doing, I am exercising this
Correct.
Muscle, whatever it may be. You know,
right.
the tendency is to want the fix, make mm-hmm. me better. But opiates don't make you better, and they're in fact making a lot of America worse. You see, you know, how crazy is it, Troy? You ask. As a Gateway faculty member, we were all given Narcan. Think about that.
That's crazy.
Just in case we come across a student or find someone in need that we possibly could implement this Narcan. As a teacher at a college.
Right. I also think, too, we have to talk about, in regards to this, the glorification. I mean, who is that? Future or whatever? Percocet or whatever?
Yeah.
I mean, one of his
yeah.
big songs. I mean, so it's glorifying
yeah.
it. Then you have the doctors doing what they're doing, mm-hmm. the big pharma companies spending billions of dollars,
yeah.
and you have a recipe for disaster.
Who's taking accountability?
Right.
Who says you know what, you shouldn't? Or who says this is actually bad? Right? Because you're hearing it from your favorite rap stars or anyone else, you know, in the mainstream media, and you're like, wow, you know, like that it can't be that bad. And then Mac Miller drops over dead. And it just kind of underneath, oh, it was just addiction problems. It was bad. What specific type of addiction, right? And what happened to this, you know, young carefree musician that now he's unresponsive and passed away? You know, what a sad story. And that narrative is happening all the time. All the time. And we're seeing it affecting younger and younger individuals. And that's
younger and younger.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you get access when you get access. You
yeah.
know, if we flooded the market with these prescription opiates, again, every adult can have their own prescription in America. That's how many are readily available, and they're not stopping. And we're seeing things like fentanyl now being very common in the pre-hospital setting, where like it's becoming more potent, it's becoming more hazardous, and you're seeing more deaths from it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it becomes more strong. These individuals are taking, you know, the same dose but at a higher concentration now, and people are dropping. So mm-hmm. what do we do? You know, like I think about this, and I've thought about this a long time. What do we do? Change the narrative. We got to change the narrative, change people's perception on it, inform people, inform the public how to prevent this. Do some narc drop-offs. You know, you have these extra meds. Don't keep them in your cabinet. You don't need to keep them for a rainy day just in case. Mm-hmm. You're done with them. Take them to the police department. Take them to these drop-off places and get rid of them. Don't have them around. Don't have them laying around, because that's where a habit, that's where a problem starts, from a loved one, from a younger one, from someone else who's in your house. That's where they first go, your drug cabinets, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But how do we fix that? Because you got to keep in mind, you know, that's what actually takes you out is respiratory depression. So when, I don't know if people really kind of know that. And this is what we'll kind of hedge off the day on, bring it right back to respiratory here. airway management. You know, these individuals honestly, and this is where I love to talk, what fixes a narcotic overdose? Do you know, Troy? We kind of talked about some medications and some things have been talked about, but you think narcotic overdose, what do you think of that fixes that?
I think what you were saying, the Narcan.
Narcan, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. True, but false at the same time. At the same time. And this is very specific to EMS. So EMS professionals, I'm talking to you. Pre-hospitally, I show up your apneic, meaning you're not breathing. You've taken too much of an opiate, some sort of narcotic, heroin maybe, whatever it may be, you are apneic, not breathing. If I sprinkle some Narcan on you, Merry Christmas, right? Does that fix my patient not breathing? No. Mm. Eventually, maybe, right? Maybe this will reverse this. If this patient metabolizes the medication appropriately, it'll reverse whatever medication is affecting them. But in the meantime, if I keep my hands in my warm pockets staring at my patient, what are they not doing? Breathing, mm-hmm. right? So there we are to our BLS airway management again. It's those skills that we learn at the basic level, BLS. You're not breathing.